Welcome back, everyone, to the channel. Tonight's video, I am giving you three terrifying deep sleep stories. Good luck going to sleep tonight. And if you do, I guarantee you, you'll have nightmares. Now let's get spooky. I remember being not much more than a child, sitting at my grandfather Dimitri's house. He smoked one cigarette after another, flicking the ashes in an old silver tray in the form of a red star. Like many of the possessions he owned, it looked 100 years old. Clouds of gray smoke billowed around his face. The strain of many years seemed to weigh on him, his shoulders slumped, his will to live broken. "Are you going to tell me the story?" I asked. He told me he would the night before. His withered, wrinkled face didn't look at me. He stared at the diary he held in his mutilated left hand, something he still owned from the siege of Leningrad. I saw drops of ancient black blood splattered the leather-bound cover. I looked at where his pinky and ring fingers used to be with horror, seeing the shiny, smooth skin laid over the stumps. His eyes, so sunken and faded, started to water. Grabbing his long white beard, he got up and started pacing. After a few minutes, he poured himself some vodka and took a few shots straight with no expression. He then turned his bright blue eyes towards me. His skinny body trembled with excitement and terror. A faraway look fell across his face. "I'll tell it to you," he said in a thick Russian accent, looking defeated. "I'll tell it to you like I told your father and uncles. A man needs to know. He needs to know what's out there." It all started with artillery fired off in the distance. I heard the loud booming, a series of shells bursting closer together, and then silence. I ran back to the apartment and told my mother and father. I was just a teenager then, 13 years old at the time, and I knew what the explosions meant. "The Germans are coming," I said, out of breath from the run. My father nodded grimly. "Dimitri, we must get as much food as we can before the markets close," my father said. We had expected this. Reports had come in of the German Wehrmacht's swift advance across the country. Fleeing refugees from cities and towns to the west of us had spoken of horrors that seemed like unbelievable urban legends at first, until more and more people came streaming in with similar stories. One survivor from the Soviet Belarusian Republic had told me that the Germans forced all the men, women, and children of their town into a large barn. They then splashed it with gasoline and set it on fire. If the people tried to run out of the burning building, the Germans would gun them down with automatic rifles. The refugee said he had only survived because he was out picking mushrooms for his family at the time. But they had taken his wife, 3 daughters, and mother from his home, forcing them all into a barn with the rest of the townspeople and started a bonfire. He said he had come out of the woods near one of the infernos and saw German soldiers laughing and passing around liquor while agonized, haunted screams echoed out of the flames. A smell like searing pork chops and burning hair filled the area. Other refugees spoke of mass graves that shifted for days after the bodies were laid in them. They said the Germans would quickly try to shoot every person in the head, but sometimes they missed or only grazed the skull. Nevertheless, the Germans were always efficient, and the stunned victim would get pushed in and buried alive. "We need to move towards the city center," my father said, glancing at my mother with his cold, steel-gray eyes. We could move into your sister's apartment, maybe. My mother nodded. My aunt lived almost directly in the center of the city, the place that would hopefully be captured last. I glanced out the kitchen window. Refugees streamed down the street, walking and hobbling in great filthy sacks. They'd carried bags of food and clothing, or pushed rolling wooden carts filled with their life's possessions. All them slouched away from the areas around the perimeter of the city and headed towards the center of Lingrad, behind the fortifications. In the distance, I heard more artillery shells exploding. The Wehrmacht seemed to be drawing closer. My father and mother grabbed bags and filled them with our meager food, jackets, and clothing. We certainly weren't rich, but we would have enough to eat for a few days at least. Little did I know it then, but the siege that started that day in September of 1941 would last for nearly 2.5 years and kill over 1 million people. By the time the city got liberated in 1944, only 700,000 people still lived and remained in Leningrad, a city of nearly 4 million people just a few years earlier. We moved into my aunt's apartment, a small two-bedroom flat not far from St. Isaac's Cathedral. The onion-shaped golden domes glistened and sparkled during the day, but the rest of the city looked gray and tired. My aunt and her husband had barely any more food than we did to feed themselves and their two children. The adults tried to ration it, but after 5 days of tiny meals and gnawing hunger, the last of the food was gone. A Red Army officially went from door to door of our first day at my aunt's apartment, giving people duties. I was told I would assemble PPD-40 machine guns for the ersatz soldiers recruited from the civilians in the city. My father, mother, aunt, and uncle were told to go help dig trenches around the city center. We had worked in starvation conditions for a couple of months like this. My mother and aunt would go out and try to dig up edible roots or collect herbs and grass for a stew. I was constantly hungry. It was like some biting creature had burrowed into my stomach. All I could do was think about food all the time. Food. The adults had come back in great pain with sores on their swollen feet. They said they had to stand in pools of stagnant water at times when they dug trenches and helped with fortifications. I could only hope they would finish long before winter and the biting winds and snow began. On a midday in November 1941, I walked up the narrow stairs of my aunt's apartment building, opening the hallway onto the third floor. I looked out the window and saw night had already come, blanketing the sky in black nothingness and gray, dirty clouds. I had my mother and father's ration cards on me, since I had grabbed our meager daily portions of sawdust bread on my way home from work. I swung the door open next to me, and I saw one of my neighbors peering out through the crack. His dark eyes met mine. His gaunt, staring face morphed into a friendly smile. Raising one hand, he hailed me and asked me to stop. I'd met him once or twice before. My father had told me his name was Mr. Kozlov. He was a laborer, and even after the period of starvation we all had endured, he still stood straight and tall with thick muscles and heavily calloused hands.
"Boy," he said conspiratorially, "come here for a moment."
Suspicious, I moved closer to the door. I smelled something delicious wafting out of his apartment. Looking towards the smell wood-burning oven in the corner of his kitchen, I saw a bubbling stew. Steam billowed upwards in fragment clouds from the concoction. "What is that delicious odor?" I said, already hooked. "Is that meat?" The man nodded happily.
I have a connection on the black market for meat, he whispered. Would you like to try a bowl? Perhaps we could find a way for you to repay me, let's say. I quickly nodded, and he motioned me into the kitchen with the wave of his massive hand. Before he closed the door, I saw him check both sides of the hallway for something. I clambered over to the pot as if in a dream. I saw thick, fresh morsels of meat mixed with carrots and cabbage and celery. It smelled like heaven. My stomach growled loudly. The government had given my family some bread cut with sawdust, and that's all we really eaten besides grass and herbs. The sawdust bread had a crunchy, woodsy taste and hurt my stomach every time I ate it. The Soviet government had cut our rations of sawdust bread 6 times in the last month and a half, since they had such a hard time getting through the German and Finnish encirclement of the city. I turned back towards Mr. Kozlov. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw something gleaming a dull silver as it swung towards me. I instinctively jumped back, my heart thumping. He was using a piece of steel rebar a few feet long, like a club trying to smash my skull in.
Stay still, boy,
he screamed, swinging the bar back and forth. It whipped through the air so close to my face that I could feel the breeze it gave off as it whistled by. I looked around for a weapon, thinking I was done. How could I fight this crazed man who was stronger than me and armed with a metal bludgeon? But at that moment, I heard the shrill cry of a Stuka dive bomber overhead, so close that it sounded like it would fly right into the building. Mr. Kozlov froze, his eyes panicked like those of a trapped animal. There was a flash of light and a roaring sound. I thought I would go deaf and blind. Walls began to collapse all around me as pillars of flame rose up, tongues of flame licking the wood hungrily. Mr. Kozlov dropped the bar, his trembling hands opening and closing. He looked straight up, and a beam from the ceiling dropped on his head. I heard the cracking of bones, blood spraying in all directions as his skull collapsed. His neck twisted and broke under the weight as he collapsed, the beam pushing him down to the ground. Clouds of black smoke billowed into the apartment in suffocating plumes, the blazing infernos behind them making them flash and flicker with orange light. A siren began to sound close by, and then 2 more started up from farther away. The shrill whine of the air raid siren rose and fell in melancholy echoes. Coughing and sputtering, I tried to make my way out of the apartment, but I got turned around in the cloying plumes of smoke. I went to the wrong room, and there, on the ground, I saw 3 naked human corpses, all lying face up. Strips of flesh were taken from their arms, legs, torso, and cheeks. The bones underneath peeked out through the mutilated flesh, gleaming and white underneath the jagged cuts. I gagged, retching, thinking of the stew that I'd come so close to eating. I turned and tried to run, feeling my way along the wall and ducking and trying to get clean air. But if I knew if I didn't get out as soon as possible, I would either suffocate or burn alive. I found the door handle leading out of the apartment. The cool metal touched my palm and I turned it, stumbling out and falling. The hallway was not yet on fire. The apartments on Mr. Kozlov's side had gotten a direct hit. Black smoke filtered from around the doors. I wondered about my family. They were only 3 apartments away. I looked in that direction and saw the front door had become a curtain of flames. Horrible screams filtered out from the shut doors of the apartments. Suddenly, the door to my aunt's apartment flew open. Dark, choking smoke tumbled into the hallway. Coughing and sputtering, I backed away.
I looked behind me and saw the stairs were still intact. A human pillar of flame shot out of my aunt's apartment. I saw my mother running, her hair on fire, her face melting and blackening. Drops of liquefied fat slid off her nose, dripping fiery oil onto her face. She gave off a low, whimpering, choking sound as she burned. She then stopped moving, swaying on her feet. Her eyes began to dribble out of their sockets. She fell limply forwards, landing on her face. Slowly, she opened and closed her fingers a few times, clenching and relaxing. Then the last of her movements stopped. New shrieks and cries of pain and terror filtered out from the apartments all around me. Covering my ears with my hands, I ran. I never saw my family again after that. Conditions quickly grew more horrifying after the bombings. I thought it was bad before, but I quickly realized just how much worse it could get. Cannibalism became rampant. Dead bodies littered the sidewalks and streets. People who died would often lay where they fell for days, unless someone took the body to eat it. It was considered lucky to be buried in a mass grave. There were simply not enough healthy people to remove the bodies from streets and houses and apartments. Most everyone was, after all, either sick or starving to death, or both. Parents no longer allowed young children to go outside by themselves because they would disappear into thin air and appear later on the black market for meat trade. Some people tried to eat wallpaper off the apartments and eat the paste. Others ate grass or tried to boil leather shoes and belts to eat them. Bugs, mice, and rats became delicacies. And anyone who had grasshoppers or crickets could trade them for a high price. I ate so many rats that I learned to think of them as tiny roasted chickens, so I could choke them down. After the death of my family, I was sent to live in a communal orphanage in the center of the city. Many children had already lost their parents to disease, starvation, bombings, or suicide. However, no leeway was given. Even children as young as 6 were sent to assemble guns or to help dig trenches. I kept my mother and father's ration cards. I never reported their deaths. I knew I could continue to claim their rations, perhaps indefinitely. I awoke on a cot in the darkness, my thin, ragged blanket barely providing any protection against the biting cold. Looking around in confusion, I wondered where I was for a long moment. And then the events of the last few months came crashing down on me. I felt the sharp hunger pangs rising up like stab wounds in my stomach. I ran my hand over my chest and felt the ribs sticking out. My skin stretched as tightly as a snare drum over the protruding bones. A small oil lamp stood on a nearby table. I walked slowly over, trying not to run into anyone else's cot. I couldn't see much more than silhouettes, but I got it lit and prepared to head towards the bathroom. Since there was no electricity or running water, the bathroom consisted of large, stinking wooden buckets that we all relieved ourselves in. The smell rising from them was atrocious, like rotting urine and hot feces mixed with the stink of sickness. A hand grabbed my shoulder. I jumped. Spinning around, I saw my mother standing there, her skin burnt to a crisp. I smelled something new now, something like burning meat and napalm.
"Dimitri,"
she whispered slowly. The blackening skin on her body cracked as she leaned forward. I saw rivulets of translucent yellow pus and streams of dark, partially clotted blood rolling down from the wounds. I backed away, knocking one of the buckets over. I felt warmth cover my shoes as the rank, liquefied sludge spilled on me. She raised her arms towards me, like a child asking to be picked up. Mother? I asked. Mother, is that really you? Please help me, she said through bleeding, cracked lips. It hurts. I had no idea how she was still alive. Something felt wrong about the situation. There was no way anyone in that condition could be alive, less likely walking and talking. I looked past the burned body, judging my chances if I tried the run.
Dimitri, please, don't you recognize your own mother?
The figure began to laugh, a sound like a choked death gasp. Patches of dead, blackened skin began to fall from the abomination's body, swaying like autumn leaves as they slowly drifted down to the cold stone floor, tatters of destroyed clothing dissolving around its torso and legs. I watched in horror as the flesh continued to dissolve. Underneath, I saw something demonic and inhuman. Its face looked flipped inside out, with gleaming muscles running across its cheeks. Its nose looked like a snake's, just two gaping holes giving a glimpse deep into the sinus passages. Blue veins and red arteries pulsed. Its eyes shone a strange gold color, filled with an inner luminosity that throbbed in time with its heartbeat. It wore a black robe that covered its demonic body. Its face twisted into an insane rictus grin as it ran at me. It came at superhuman speed, a blur of dark motion. Instinctively, I grabbed the handle of one of the buckets nearest my feet. The handle was slick with human waste. As it reached me, I swung the bucket with all my strength at its demonic face. Its grin seemed to falter for a moment as the wood smashed into the side of its mouth. Crap and piss exploded in a disgusting geyser. The bucket broke into 1,000 splinters. I felt my face get splattered with the waste. It went in my mouth and my eyes. Spitting and gagging, I ran. Screaming in terror, I ended up waking up everyone else in the sleeping chamber. They looked at me with panic and curiosity. I could only imagine what they saw. A young, wild-eyed boy covered in crap. But when they went to investigate the bathroom, they found it empty, except for a mess of exploded crap on the walls and ceilings, of course. Over the next couple of days, I felt constantly watched. I would feel eyes running over the back of my neck. Sometimes I could catch glimpses of a red, gleaming face staring out from an alleyway or an apartment window, its eyes glowing like twin sunsets. I knew I needed to get out of the city as soon as possible, but there was simply no way except by plane. Even with my father and mother's ration cards, I continued to starve. Bread rations got cut even more as the city quickly ran out of food. People began to go mad with hunger, and some were prosecuted for ripping flesh off dead corpses with their bare teeth in public. I had gotten to the point where I began to look longingly at the dead bodies littering the sidewalk on the way home from work. I could only imagine how much meat a single human body held. At this point, I would do anything just to feel full for 5 minutes. As I walked past the golden onion domes of St. Isaac's Cathedral one night that week, the corpses of a child near my feet suddenly stirred. Its hands twitched. I looked down at its cyantic blue lips and open, staring eyes, a sense of wonder and horror rising in my chest. Then it blinked. I jumped back and screamed as its hands snaked out, grabbing at my ankle. Its eyes started to glow with that horrible golden light. Its grin spread, ripping the flesh of the boy's cheeks with a soft, tearing sound. Cold, clotted blood dripped down from the wound. I am hungry, so hungry, Dimitri, the abomination said in a child's voice. Will you not feed the poor, starving boy? Before I could react, Its head jerked forward and its slit mouth opened wide. I felt a burning pain on my left hand. Looking down, I saw it had bitten off two of my fingers. Agony rose up through my arm in horrible wrenching waves. I yelled for help, falling back. A few other people were nearby and they came running. They found me lying there, crying and hugging my mutilated hand, the corpse of a dead boy only inches away. By that, I decided I needed to get out of the city by any means necessary. I decided my best bet was to go north, where the Finns laid siege. I definitely wasn't going south, where the National Socialists waited. Getting out of the city was no easy task, especially with one particularly fingerless hand throbbed and still oozing blood. But I didn't want to risk spending one more night here. I thought that if I did, I would wake up to find that abomination standing over me, ready to rip my throat out. I had to get around the Red Army's sentries to get to the Finnish military. I knew the city as well as anyone, having lived there my entire life. In the darkness of night, I crept past dreary apartment buildings and half-destroyed homes. Luckily, the first sentry I found was sleeping, an empty bottle of homemade vodka laying at his feet. I reached the edge of the city and saw countless trenches stretching ahead of me. I looked down at the sentry and saw he had a rifle slung around his shoulder. I tiptoed close to the man, deciding to take his weapon in case I needed it. He snored loudly, his emaciated face twitching as he dreamt. Very carefully, I began to lift the rifle off his body. It was nearly over the top of his head when the man woke. He rose with a stare, his eyes flying open. I saw golden light streaming out of them, and he grabbed my right hand tightly.
"Leaving so soon?"
it cried in a hoarse voice. I pulled away, kicking and fighting. The rifle clattered to the trench's dirt floor with a thud. I lunged for it. The abomination came at me, its body transforming in a flash into its true form. I raised the rifle and shot it in the chest. It shrieked, an inhuman wail that echoed through the night around us. Then I ran for my life. I ended up making it outside the fortifications, though the last sentry fired a shot at me as I passed. I heard it whistle near my head, but I didn't slow. I knew if I stayed here another minute, I would die. The Finnish sentries ended up seeing me and screaming orders. I dropped the gun and told them I was a defector. They quickly arrested me and brought me to a prisoner of war camp, where I spent the rest of the war. Hell, compared to what I had seen in the city, the prisoner of war camp was basically a vacation. I later met your grandmother and we immigrated to the United States. I thought I had lost that abomination forever until a few days ago. I heard a sound in the backyard and looked down from the window. And staring there, in a black robe, I saw two golden eyes, spinning with their own inner light. We used to have to take the corpses out with canes, he told me one time, because they were so intertwined. Entire pyramids of bodies, people climbing on top of one another, clawing each other to get away from the gas. They used to tell us it was a quick death, but everyone knew it wasn't. The screaming in the chamber would go on for 15 or 20 minutes. They used to put a little glass window in the doors so the doctors could look in and watch. My grandfather, Alexander, had told me about his time in the Sonderkommando, the corpse units of the National Socialist Conservation Camps. He had been arrested in Poland simply because he had been a leader in his field and an intellectual with the history of supporting Polish nationalism. This had raised red flags, and during a roundup of the intelligentsia, my father had also been arrested and tortured by the Gestapo. They had made him sign something he never got to read, and then he had been moved to a prison and eventually to his new job. The day it happened, he said, my friend Bartek and I were on duty. Our job was to lend the people towards the chambers without alerting them or causing a riot. The Sonderkommando all used lines like, don't forget where you put your clothing, because you'll need to come back to them. Or, tie your shoes together for convenience to make it easier to find them when you come back. We always emphasized how they would come back after their shower. But I never looked in their eyes when I said it. He stared out the window for a long moment at this, his mug of coffee steaming in front of him. I knew not to interrupt him. He often talked to me about his experiences. It seemed like he wanted the dry poison out of his memories, and letting him talk seemed to help him do it. So the chamber was packed as always, he said. 800 people smashed into a tiny area like sardines. To get the last ones in, the SS would often beat and bludgeon people. The claustrophobia must have been horrifying. The lack of air, the packed chamber like a massive coffin. By the time they slammed the door closed, there wasn't an extra inch of space into the entire chamber. In fact, after they opened the door, their bodies would often still be standing because there was simply no room for them to fall down. Except for the middle of the chamber, of course. There, people lived longest, and they tried to escape from the gas. We would see infants and small children at the bottom of the human pyramid, smothered and stampeded. The stronger ones would be at the top, having climbed over the bodies of the others trying to get air at the top of the chamber. The gas did have a tendency to fall, depending on the temperature and humidity. When they opened the doors, Bartek and I walked in along with other Sonderkommando. We used long chains to pull the bodies apart. At first, a Sonderkommando would treat the bodies with respect. But after tens of thousands of bodies, you'd just start throwing them like bags of potatoes. It was our job, after all. He said this with an ironic misery, his eyes misty. Bartek and I would then pile the bodies on carts to be brought to the other teams of Sonderkommando. One team, which we called the dentists, would rip the gold teeth out so they could melt it down into bars and send them back to Germany. Another would shave all the remaining hair off of the corpses. They had shaved them when they first had got there, but any remaining would make the crematoria reek of burning hair. Bartek and I were moving our carts of corpses up the lift elevators when a commotion suddenly broke out into the nearby medical barracks. They called it a medical barracks, but in reality, it was mostly a place where doctors experimented on people, and the sick were often given lethal doses of fentanyl intravenously. This also wasn't a quick death, as the person would begin to get agonizing cramps and a burning sensation before devolving into unconsciousness. I had no idea what was going on. At first, I thought the SS was trying to prevent a prisoner escape, or perhaps someone had already escaped and they were in an uproar. It looked like someone had kicked a hornet's nest. I saw government vehicles speeding in with fully armed troops. The guards surrounded the gates of the camp, a thick ring of black-suited soldiers. I saw a doctor running out of the barracks with blood covering his white lab coat. His eyes looked wild, and he screamed something in German to the soldiers. He kept screaming it over and over. "Die Wufflin! Die Wufflin!" he said. Most of the Sonderkommando, including myself, knew at least some German. It is, after all, the administrative language of the National Socialist State, and the Germans never deigned to speak to us in our own languages, unless they were torturing us or trying to get information. By this time, Bartek and I had paused, a cart full of emaciated, naked corpses lying in front of each of us. The doctor ran past us, not noticing us, his eyes wild. He continued to scream gibberish in German, speaking so fast I could barely understand anything except two words. The girl and the wolf. What in the hell do you think this is about? Bartek asked me, his blue eyes wide and uncertain. He just shook his head, feeling numb. I hadn't felt such of anything in months, to be honest. I'd closed myself down emotionally, psychologically removing myself from the present. I saw much of this as if it was happening to someone else. It was my mind, I think, trying to protect me. Even now, looking back, I feel like I'm telling someone else's story sometimes. A torrent of gunfire erupted from the medical barracks, and then a woman ran out, a nurse. Her face looked like a mask of gore. One eye hung limply from its socket, and her entire left cheek hung down, a flap of skin revealing the tooth beyond, like some sort of grotesque half-smile. In her remaining eye, I saw mortal terror and fear. Seeing it coming from her captors loosened something inside of me. Bartek felt the same way. We left our carts a dead and turned to run. At that moment, something tore its way out of the barracks. As I saw what it was, I began running with all the energy that my starving body could provide. It was a girl, or at least, it had been. She looked no older than 12 or 13, and she wore a stripped uniform soaked in blood. Her arms and legs lengthened before my eyes, forming long claws that erupted from their fingers. Her mouth had formed into a strange rictus grin, with drops of blood falling from her sharpening teeth. Stringy black hair seemed to grow from her head, and her eyes turned yellow, with slitted demonic pupils glimming in the center, emanating a bloodlust and fury I had never seen before. The SS guards and soldiers had streamed in the front gates by this point, running at her and shouting orders. Automatic rifles began the fire, and Bartek grabbed my hand and pulled me down to the ground just in time. I heard the bullets whizzing over my head, smashing into the crematoria's chimneys and the surrounding barracks. I knew they weren't shooting at me, but so many soldiers had opened fire that the entire area had turned into a shooting gallery. I looked back and saw bullets ripping into the girl's body. Gore blossomed from her chest, blood and flesh exploding out of the exit wounds. Covering the bare dirt around her, with a roar, she jumped on top of the barracks, leaping 20 feet into the air. To my amazement, I watched the wounds healing before my eyes. I wondered what kind of strange medical experience this was that could produce such an effect. Bartek shook me, telling me, "We have to run. We have to get out." But I just stayed there, shell-shocked. He slapped me, pulling me up and towards the gas chamber. "We could barricade ourselves inside the chamber," he said. I gasped. "I'm not going to lock myself in there," I shouted, waves of anxiety rising in my chest. I had images of the door slamming closed and the chemicals being poured through the vents. I shuddered. But we kept running towards it, not knowing where else to go. As we got inside the crematoria, the windows smashed inwards, and I saw the girl had followed us. She had completely transformed by this point. Her skin looked yellow and paper against her long wolfish frame. Tatters of her blood-stained uniform still clung to her body. I saw no marks from where the bullets had struck her. She ran forwards at us, slashing out with a clawed hand. Bartek pushed me just in time, and I fell, the claw missing my face by a fraction of an inch. I began to crawl away, looking back as Bartek began to cry out in terror. I looked and I saw him backing away from her, his hands raised, pleading. "I don't want to die. I don't want to die," he kept saying. In a blur, she leaped forward, ripping at his throat. The blood rictus grin still plastered across her face. A torrent of blood rushed from the gaping wound, soaking the front of his body. She opened her mouth wide and drank the spouting arterial stream, sucking at it as she held up her body with clawed hands. When she was done, she threw it aside and looked down at me. I began to rise, to jump up and began to run when she tackled me from behind. I felt a searing pain in my back as her claw connected, leaving deep gouges. I felt something sticky and warm flowing down my back, soaking into the rips in my uniform. At that moment, a dozen SS men ran in the front door and began shooting. I was on the floor after she clawed me, which turned out to be lucky as the bullets went over me. Hissing and spitting blood, I turned my head at the last moment to see the girl galloping away from me on all fours, her freakishly long arms giving her a loping stride. She jumped back through the shattered window she had come in. The SS men all ran out after her, and I found myself alone with Bartek's body. I got up and found the rest of the prisoners confined to their barracks with armed guards watching each of the groups. The guards had left the front of the camp in a hurry, and I saw the gates stood wide open. With blood pouring down my back, I began to creep through the shadows of the camp, checking the watchtowers and the front gates for people. They had all joined in the pursuit or were the confined prisoners in the barracks, and they had apparently forgotten about a lone Sonderkommando like myself. I finally made my way outside. I didn't see a single other prisoner or guard in the front. But when I looked back, before I left for the final time, I saw the girl leaping over the razor wire fence as countless soldiers pursued her. "Good for you," I said to myself. "Good for you." As the sun set, I saw the first silhouettes across the field. My grandfather sat, smoking and reading on the rocking chair in the back of the house. I ran to him, scared and uncertain. "There's people coming, Grandpa," I said. He flicked a cigarette on the ashtray, put down his book, and turned and looked me straight in the eyes. "Where? Who?" he said, his clear blue eyes searching my face. "I don't know, but there's dozens of them, I think," I said. I couldn't see their faces or anything. They just looked like shadows moving across the field. He stood up quickly, knocking the ashtray off of the small table to his right. Cigarette butts were flying all over the floor, and a cloud of ashes got swept up by the wind. "Where's Grandma?" he asked, his face growing grave. A crease appeared across his forehead, and he looked around quickly. "I don't know, but they're coming fast," I said. He began limping inside the house, his bad legs slowing him down. He looked out the front window and gasped. Quietly, I came up behind him and stared out at the field, covered in a deep orange and red hues from the sun, covered up by clouds as day rolled into night. "We need to find Grandma right now," my grandfather said. He went to the kitchen and unlocked the safe, taking out his .223 rifle, which he mostly used to kill coyotes and foxes who hunted his chickens or attacked the baby pigs out in the barn. "I don't get what it is," I said, staring out the window. It seemed like hundreds of black spots now approached, spread over the field. The ones closest I saw were not human at all. They walked on their hands and feet, with shining black skin stretched thinly over their bones and joints. Silver tendrils of saliva rolled down from their mouths. And every time one of them got too close to another, they would begin to snap and hiss, their sharp, serrated teeth flashing with every bite. Their eyes had a strange look of a goat's eyes with rectangular pupils. Placed on each side of their face, it looked like a small island of light in the darkness of space. The rest of their naked bodies seemed to sunk in the light, causing a slight shimmering on their reptilian skins.
Oh God, they're back,
my grandfather said. Last time they came, they killed off half the town.
Where's Grandma?
I asked, a current of anxiety running through my body now. My grandfather shook his head.
I wish I knew, he said. When's the last time you saw her?
She was weeding in the garden and then said it would be dark soon and she would start putting the tools away, I said, suddenly remembering. She's probably out in the shed right now. My grandfather grabbed the gun and ran out the door, at least as much as he could run. It ended up being more of a fast, limping walk. By this point, the first of the creatures had nearly reached the front of the house. We went out the back door, looking towards the shed. I saw the light on inside and the door wide open.
Grandma!
I screamed. My grandfather jumped, then he put his free hand over my mouth, holding the gun loosely in the other.
You idiot!
He hissed. Don't draw them near! Keep quiet! Do you want to die? But it was too late. I heard growling and snapping from the front of the house, and the smashing of windows and doors. Then, on all fours, a few of the abominations came running around the side of the old farmhouse, attracted by my screaming. They hopped in a strange way, their abnormally long and thin arms going between their bodies as their legs pushed them forwards in constant jumping motions. They moved fast now, much faster than me, and in the growing darkness, they seemed little more than a blur. My grandfather grabbed my hand and we ran towards the shed, slamming the door behind us. I looked back in the corner and saw Grandma, totally oblivious to everything going on, sorting through the tools and small weed containers.
Ah, we need more basil and rosemary, she said to herself. Never have enough seeds, it seems.
She looked back at us, smiling.
Have you come to help? I'm sorry to say, I'm nearly done.
No,
my grandfather said, raising his gun for emphasis. We're being attacked. You need to stay with us. Remember what killed the Kellers and the Cavendish family and their dogs and cats and cattle? My grandmother's face went pale, and I thought she might pass out for a moment. She grabbed her chest, breathing hard.
But that was 30 years ago, she said. How could they be back?
My grandfather just shook his head.
They're here, he said.
As if on cue, someone started smashing on the locked door of the shed. Then another pair had joined in, and another. It sounded like a riot had broken out on the other side of the wall. My grandfather raised the gun, as if to start shooting through the door. Then he checked his pocket and frowned.
Dang it, should have grabbed more ammo,
he said, rifling through a few bullets in his overalls. He looked like he had grabbed a couple dozen from the safe, though even with perfect aim, that wouldn't make much of a dent in the crowd of beasts I had seen.
Go out the back door, my grandmother said. We'll go escape in the woods. We could come out to the Jefferson's house if we take the dirt trail.
Fine, fine, my grandfather said, pushing me forwards and grabbing my grandmother's hand.
He looked out the side door of the shed. The beasts still pounded on the front door, and I heard the wood begin to splinter and give way.
Coast is clear, he said quickly.
And we ran out through the field and towards the woods. Behind us, I heard the door fall, and the last rotten beam shattered as the black creatures moved inside.
What if they're already at the Jefferson's place? I asked my grandfather in a low tone.
We ran through the corn plants, though my grandmother and grandfather couldn't move very fast. I could hear the creatures howling with rage and sniffing the air from the shed behind us.
Then we deal with it, my grandfather whispered.
I heard the first heavy booming steps as the creatures gave chase, running over the corn plants and knocking them down with a wispy echoing sound. By the time we got into the forest, the creatures had circled us. Some had run ahead and some followed close behind, but they kept a distance of 10 feet,
as if simply watching and stalking. My grandfather stopped and raised his gun. With a deafening boom, he shot at the first silhouette he saw on the trail. The bullet went high, and with a deep growl, the creature disappeared into the brush. My grandfather motioned us forward, and we walked down the trail close together in a group. Anytime he saw the slightest movement, he would shoot in that direction. One of the creatures seemed to have been hit, and on the trail I saw black blood shining under the moonlight. Droplets disappeared into ferns and crickets that surrounded the trail, and for a moment, I thought I saw eyes gleaming through the brush. Then they were gone. My grandmother reached out for my hand. "It's going to be okay," she said reassuringly, patting me. "We've survived this before. We'll make it this time." My grandfather shook his head, but he said nothing. As we got to the Jeffersons' house, I saw a light shining in every window, hope roaring inside me, until I saw the bodies strewn across the porch. The mother had her head ripped off. I saw a body with a blood-stained dress, the neck a mess of gore and bones. Looking up, I saw the head staged neatly on the metal fence post, the spike driving into the throat. Her eyes looked blank, her expression a mask of horror. The mouth stood silently open, and the lips looked blue. The rest of the family laid around her, disemboweled, their eyes ripped out, the soft flesh eaten off of their faces. My grandmother pulled me to the side, looking over at my grandfather. Then she began laughing. He turned to her, confused. My pets, she said in some insane voice. They're here for you. They'll take whatever they want. Hungry work, you know. What? My grandfather asked, a certainty and bitterness crossing his eyes as he stared at his wife with distrust. I know you're sleeping with Mrs. Keller, my grandmother said, her eyes turning dark and her features savage. She grinned, showing all her teeth. My grandfather stepped back, muttering excuses and saying how it wasn't true.
You killed them? He asked. And you did this?
I did what I had to protect me and my grandson from monsters like you, she said. And with a nod of her head, the creatures came out of the woods, grabbing my grandfather and dragging him away. He shot his gun, emptying the clip and blowing apart the heads of three or four, but dozens more followed from behind, hissing and biting at the air. I heard his screams and the breaking of his bones as they savaged him, biting and stomping on him, ripping at his throat and face. Soon he disappeared into the darkness, and the last gurgling scream echoed behind us. My grandmother turned to me, her normal, placid, friendly expression back on her face. Well, she said, that was quite a day. How about we go home and have some ice cream? I could really go for some ice cream. And so we turned around and left, and I never asked her about any of it. My grandmother recently died, and I found a book in the attic while cleaning out the farmhouse. It looked like it had a cover made of human skin, and in the middle it said, in blood red letters, "Summoning spells and necromancy."